thank thee that in these last days thou hast spoken unto us in thy Son, the Lord Jesus Christ, whom thou hast made to be the heir of all things. We thank thee for the clarity of the revelation given in him. We thank thee that it is a message of grace that comes to us on the basis of what he has wrought in our behalf. We thank thee that through this Son of thine, O Lord, that there has been established a new covenant with better promises than that old covenant. We thank thee that in him we have the surety of life everlasting, of fellowship with thee. And so we rejoice in thee, and we thank thee for thy word. And we pray that tonight, as we study from thy servant Hosea and the message of his life as thou didst structure it, that our thoughts and our eyes and our faith might be directed unto that one to whom his life experience pointed, even to the Lord Christ, who takes us to be his bride, to be his wife forevermore in all faithfulness. So bless us, we pray thee, and help us to exalt thy name in our hearts through Christ our Lord. Amen. All right, so tonight we have the book of Hosea as our study, and it's will be useful for sort of bringing together and summarizing a lot of the things we've been trying to do in the course so far, especially then if we think of the way we started with what was a prophet and what was his function, and the way we developed that in terms of their conducting the, as God's lawyers, the lawsuit of the covenant of works, and yet at the same time they were remembering that the Abrahamic covenant had not been annulled by the addition of this Mosaic, this old covenant of works, but that it was still intact. It was the substratum, it was the infrastructure, the ongoing covenant of salvation by grace. And so the prophets had this second happier task of heralding the new covenant. And as we look at Hosea now, and we'll be concentrating on the first three chapters, this life marriage experience of Hosea's sort of an historic parable that the Lord set up, we'll see that that's precisely what Hosea now is doing. So we're using him as an illustration. Here he is, he's an 8th century prophet to Israel, and he provides here in these opening three chapters just a perfect illustration of this dual role, lawsuit plus heralding the new covenant. In fact, that becomes the structure of these chapters as we look at them. So this will afford us then an opportunity to see what we've been trying to say in a general way in concrete action in this particular prophet. And one other thing that we've been, that has, it keeps emerging inevitably in our study of the Old Testament prophets, is this thing that we've been calling prophetic idiom, which is to say that the way in which the Old Testament prophets, in fulfilling their function as heralds of the new covenant, employ the contemporary situation of the old covenant to provide us with the images of new covenant realities, so that we, reading the Old Testament prophets, have the task then of translating them from that Old Testament idiom into the appropriate corresponding new covenant messianic realities. And we'll find that these first three chapters of Hosea provide us with some helpful direction in arriving at a proper hermeneutic for the interpretation of the prophets. So let's then turn in our Bibles, and hopefully there's some Hebrew Bibles around. We'll be reading from the Hebrew some more tonight. One other thing that we'll want to do, and perhaps start with it, is to make the point again that Moses stands at the beginning of this whole history of the prophets as the model, the paradigm, whose ministry is echoed and carried forward in the prophets whom God raised up, like unto you, Moses, as God said to Moses. Now, in those first three chapters, then, you're familiar with the general picture there, how God comes to Hosea and tells him to marry this woman, Gomer, whom he designates in the Hebrew as an Eshet Zinunim, a woman of whoredoms. And so he is to take this Eshet Zinunim, and not just the woman of whoredoms, but also along with her, what the Hebrew calls then the Yalde Zinunim, the children of whoredoms. And so here is a puzzler for us as to, you know, the moral aspect of this. What is God requiring of Hosea in this situation, and is it compatible with the general moral demands of God that we find in the Bible? But in any case, here he takes this woman and has these children by her and so on. And in this life experience then of his marriage to Gomer, we see a picture of God's relationship with Israel, which is, of course, a common image in the Bible of God taking the people to himself as his wife, and then there's the unfaithfulness of the wife and so on. But this is the picture now that emerges in these opening three chapters. And there's some sort of a separation that takes place, and then there is a reunion that is described in the third chapter. And the third chapter is the real interesting one, I think, and is the crux of the whole matter. But as we read through here, we read about the language of the unfaithfulness, the whoredoms, and the way in which this involves a provoking to jealousy and on God's part and so on. But there's all this language then of the arousing of jealousy and the provoking to wrath that we read about here in Hosea 1 through 3. And where does this all come from? It all comes from Moses already. So what we're trying to show is that already in Moses, the imagery and the message and everything that we're going to find in Hosea 1 through 3 was already anticipated. And most specifically, and when I look at Deuteronomy 31 and 32, or at least a few verses from each one of those, just to see how Hosea, these hundreds of years later, is drawing so heavily upon what Moses had already set forth, not just concerning the basic message, but even the imagery and so on in which it is developed. Now, that's one thing we want to do. And let's say right away, another thing that we want to notice right away, here we have a passage. What's it dealing with, really? We turn to the New Testament, to Romans 9, was around 24, 25, 26, and to 1 Peter 2, verse 10. And we find here that the apostles of the Lord, both Paul and Peter then, Paul and Romans, Peter and 1 Peter, citing from Hosea, here and applying it definitely to the church situation, so that there shouldn't be any question in our minds as to the basic hermeneutical direction. As we study the Hosea 1 through 3, we should expect then to find that here are prophecies of the new covenant. That's the way Paul interpreted it, the business of here was a people who were lo ami, not my people, and so on, and now they are the people of the Lord. We talked about Noah's oracle to Japheth. Here are the Japhethites coming into the tents of Shem. In terms of the Abrahamic promises, here are all the nations of the earth being blessed in the seed of Abraham. Here is that message coming before us again in Hosea, according to the Pauline and interpretation of Peter. They saw in Hosea a prophecy of carrying forward what Noah had said and what God said to Abraham, that the day was coming when those who had not been God's people, who had been far off and aliens from the Commonwealth of Israel, were brought in. The universalism of the Messianic age, that's what we are led to anticipate. We will find in Hosea, as we listen to the New Testament interpretation of Paul and Peter. Well, and let's start by going back to Moses and just seeing how Moses, in Moses we have the roots of what Hosea develops. And as I said, Deuteronomy 31 and 32, in Deuteronomy 31, verses 16 through 18 roughly, and in Deuteronomy 32, verses 20 and 21. Now the way I interpret Hosea's experience, this is the way the text itself makes plain enough what's going on, especially in the third chapter where God says to him, you do this because that's the way I relate to Israel. And so I think that in order to understand precisely what this situation is with Gomer, who she was, what kind of a woman she was when Hosea married her and so on, we get the right answer to that if we go back here and see what was happening in Deuteronomy in the days of Moses. Now, what was happening? Moses here was calling Israel now into a covenant, a covenant of marriage, if you will, with the Lord. And as the Lord takes this people to himself, does he know how it's all going to turn out? Of course he does. He knows beforehand what is in their hearts. Now, the Bible in various places suggests that right here at the beginning of God's experience with Israel, or Israel's experience with the Lord at the Exodus, as they make covenant together, yes, Israel is, of course, sinful, but it's looked on well. There was an initial period of sort of purity, if you will. There is a making of marriage commitments which can be taken at face value, and the Lord does. So there's the honeymoon, and things are okay right at the start. And yet the Lord knows what will happen soon enough. He knows what is in the hearts of this people. He knows that soon enough Moses will hardly be dead and gone, and they will be rising up. In fact, that's what one of these verses we'll be looking at says. And they will be breaking their marriage covenant with the Lord. Nevertheless, in spite of the fact that the Lord knows what is in the hearts of this people whom he is taking as his bride, nevertheless, he makes covenant of marriage with them. Now, I think that's the explanation of what's going on with Hosea. We'll come back to this. But as I see it, Hosea, as she's described there in those opening verses as an Eshet Zinunim, a woman of whoredoms, is being described in terms of the propensities of her heart, that what she is going to become, what the Lord knows she's going to develop into in due time, but not yet expressing it. And so I think that will be the clue to our understanding just what the Lord required Hosea to do on this particular occasion, just what sort of a woman was. Hosea must do it because the Lord did it. And the Lord enters into this marriage knowing what Israel would become. Hosea must enter into this marriage with this woman knowing by the Lord's information given to him what she was eventually going to become, even though she hasn't expressed it outwardly from the outset. That's the way I understand it, because of my recognizing the dependence of Hosea here upon Moses. So let's look at Deuteronomy 31 and verses 16 through 18, perhaps. And I, as usual, encourage everyone that has some of the Hebrew and has their Hebrew Bibles to try to follow along here. So the Lord said to Moses, look now, you are about to lie down with your fathers. Well, you know, this is the last day of his life. He's setting the house of God in order. He's making this covenant renewal arrangement with Israel, whereby Israel's committing themselves to accept God's appointed successor to Moses, namely Joshua. That's the main thrust of what's of this occasion. And that's reflected here in this verse. Moses, you're about to die. You're about to lie down now here with your fathers. You're making this the marriage covenant between me and Israel, and then you are about to die. And quickly, right on the heels of that, it says, and this people will come, will rise up with zana. Now, here's this term, zana, to commit prostitution, adultery, which is used over and again in Hosea, and here it is to describe the way Israel was going to behave as soon as Moses was dead and gone. So this people then is going to rise up, and they will commit unfaithfulness after the gods of the foreign land, which they are there in their midst. So Israel's about to enter into the land of the Canaanites, and with their Baal gods, and Israel's going to be unfaithful to the Lord and be giving themselves over to these gods of this foreign land. And let's see where we are here. And they will abandon me. So they will, azav is the Hebrew word, they will abandon, they will forsake their true heavenly spouse. And heper, a common verb for breaking a covenant, the verb parer, they will break my covenant, which I have made, literally cut, with them. And my response then, what will happen is Israel will break the marriage covenant. The Lord will be the wrathful husband. And verse 17 says, and my anger will burn in me in that day. And now you keep getting this sort of lex talionis. Israel does something and God responds in kind. The same Hebrew verb is used here, azav. They will abandon me. And now God uses the same verb for what he will do to them. And I will abandon them. So my anger will rise up against them because of their unfaithfulness, and I will abandon them. And now we have another verb here. Those of you who have the Hebrew text, it's histerete. And there are two ways of parsing this verb in terms of the basic sense. It comes out the same. One meaning, one explanation of this is it comes from the hollow verb tsur, which means to turn. And so if that's what it was, it would mean, and I will turn my face from them. So that's one possibility. The other possibility is that the verb is safer, which means to hide. So the image is either that of I will turn my face from them, or I will hide my face from them, and it really doesn't matter very much in terms of the sense. The thought is then that God will no longer be paying the kind of a husbandly attention to them that will result in their being protected and provided for and so on, but rather he will be delivering them over to their enemies. So I will abandon them. And we can translate it either way. Let's just use the translation hide, the other option to turn aside. And I will hide my face from them, and they shall be literally for devouring. The result of my abandoning my care from them is that they will be exposed to all kinds of threats and dangers, and they will be devoured by their enemies, and they shall be for devouring. And also then it goes on to say that there shall find them many evils and troubles. So all kinds of woe will overtake them. And he said in that, and they will say, they will say in that day, those of you who are looking at Hebrew, you'll see that the verbs are singular because it's referring to the collective word am for the people. But it's so it's they. And they will say in that day, is it not because my God is no longer in my midst that these evils have overcome me? So they'll recognize the true explanation of their troubles is that God is no longer with them, and therefore the curses of the covenant have overtaken them. And then verse 18 continues the thought, repeats the idea of God's hiding his face, and he says, and I will hide, and this the idea of hiding is underscored by using an infinitive absolute with the finite verb. Hiding, I will hide. I will indeed hide my face in that day because of the evil which they have done, for they will have turned unto other gods. So there it is. The marriage then is undertaken here through the mediatorship of Moses. Moses is about to die. But very quickly they will be giving themselves over to prostitution, worship of the Baal gods, and with the entail of it will be God's judgments upon them. Very similar language is used in chapter 32, But with it also this language of jealousy and provocation and so on that we want to note in chapter 32, if you could turn over there, and verses 20 and 21. Again, that same verb of disputed meaning, whether turn your face away or hide, and we'll continue to go with a hide translation. So verse 20, and he said, I will hide my face from them. Now, leading up to this chapter 32, you recall, we've looked at it on several occasions, is a so-called song of Moses, and it, you remember, was a witness song in which, in effect, Moses is ahead of time virtually conducting the lawsuit against Israel precisely because he knows what they are to do not long after the marriage. And so as you go through chapter 32, the lawsuit form reflecting the treaty form begins by telling you of the claims of the Lord upon Israel, who he was, and especially all the good things he'd done for them in the Exodus and so on. And then it quickly moves into the way in which they have violated the stipulations. And then the following that, of course, we'd expect something about the sanctions of the covenant and especially the curses. And that's what we're into here in Deuteronomy 32, verse 20. And so now God is part of this general indictment, threatening them with the sentence of judgment. And he said, I will hide my face from them, and then we will see what will be a haritham. Last week, we, dealing with Genesis 49, verse 1, we saw how Jacob gathered his sons together in order to make known to them that which was going to happen to them. And here's this same word, ba'acharit hayamim, at the end of the days. Remember our discussion of that expression, ba'acharit hayamim, eschatological expression referring to the ultimate outcome of things on the far messianic horizon. Well, now we have that same word, acharit, before us here. God will abandon them, and then we will see what the issue of it all will be, what the outcome of their unfaithfulness will be. For a generation, he goes on to say, of perverseness are they, the children in whom there is no faithfulness. And verse 21, they will make me jealous, the verb kana. All right, now here's again where we get that lex talionis. Israel does something to God, and then he does the same thing back to them. They will make me jealous, below El, the Hebrew says. Lo, the negative, El, God. They are going to make me jealous with a not God, with a low ale, negative, and the word for a deity, low ale. They will make me jealous with that which is not a God. Then the verb ka'as, they will provoke me. And now we get another term for idols with these vanities, these low ale things, these things that claim to be God or but are no gods. And so you're going to cite me to jealousy. You're going to provoke me with these things that are not really gods. And now in retaliation, God threatens, I will make them jealous below am. So you get the same negative, lo, but instead of ale, which means God, you have the word am, which means people. So Israel is the people, but the only real people is the covenant people when it comes right down to it, and then the rest don't count. And so God is going to bring judgment against them, as we know how it turns out, by the Assyrians and the Babylonians and all these foreign nations who are not covenant people and therefore are really no people at all. In the last analysis, they don't count. And so God is going to use this low arm, these not people, in order to incite to jealousy those who, by their calling, were a people of God, but who were going to become low on me, not my people at all presently. But he says, and so I will incite them to jealousy with a not people, and then synonymous with low am, not people, is with a goy naval, a nation, a foolish nation. Just as real peoplehood belongs only to those who are covenant people, so real wisdom belongs only to those who have the knowledge of the covenant. And in fact, in the book of Deuteronomy, that's the way wisdom is defined. It's in terms, what is wisdom? Wisdom is to have the covenant terms of God to know them, and especially then to do them. And foolishness, then it's not a low IQ. You can have a tremendous IQ and still be what is here described as a goy naval, a foolish nation, if with all of your wisdom you are not heeding the claims of the sovereign creator. And so with these foreign nations, these not people, these foolish nations, these people who know not God and are without God, God will provoke them. So now there is the language then that the whole situation and the imagery and so on that Hosea picks up on. So just another illustration for us of the continuity of the divine revelation and the paradigmatic role played by Moses. His material is just so germinal for all of the rest of the Old Testament revelation. All right. Now, coming to Hosea in chapter 1, we right away then have this particular problem of the marriage and how it fits in with, requirements elsewhere in the Old Testament. So I have some Dead Sea Scrolls here. We'll read from. Just kidding. All right.
Remarkably well preserved.
Yeah, aren't they? They use good paper.
How did you get the curl out of
it? All right. Well, the opening verse identifies the historical situation of Hosea. He's the 8th century. He's, of course, prophet to the northern kingdom. And so the first verse takes care of the names of the various kings. Then coming to the second verse, it begins with actually a little grammatical rarity. It's the beginning of the Lord spoke. Those of you who are the Hebrew scholars, after a noun and the construct, you would expect that what would follow would be a verb, which would be an infinitive construct. But rarely a noun and the construct may be followed by a finite verb, and that's what we have here. So literally, it's the beginning of the Lord spoke. But in smoothing it out in English, here's when the Lord's revelation began to Hosea and how it all began. So the beginning of the Lord speaking unto Hosea, and this is what Hosea's surprised ears heard. The Lord said unto Hosea, Lekach lecha, go take for yourself Eshet Zinonim, a wife of whoredoms. Now the Hebrew word take, halak, lakak, is the normal one for to take into marriage. So he's saying, go now and marry a certain woman who is then described, as we've said, as an Eshet Zinonim, a woman of whoredoms. And tacked on right away is also Wiyalde, which is children, and children of whoredoms. And the explanation is given right away, which brings out what is perfectly obvious, that Moses' marriage experience was to be a reflexive picture of God's relationship to Israel, because it goes on to say, you do this because the land, that is the land of Israel, which stands for the population, the land of Israel, and again, we have one of those infinitive absolutes here added to the finite verb to emphasize the verb. The land of Israel is altogether given over to committing whoredom from after the Lord. Now, there's the basic situation. And so who did the Lord say he was to marry? And assuming that it was someone who was already engaged in some sort of prostitution, the commentators, we can understand through the years, have been hesitant to accept that at face value because they think that would be involve a contradiction in God's giving certain moral legislative requirements for marriage in one place, and then in dealing with his own prophet, commanding him to violate them. And so there have been various attempts to get away from that. You know, you're familiar with the way in which some would just want to take this as just a literary allegory of some kind or a vision. But you know, that if there were a moral problem there, putting it in a vision or some other form rather than plain obvious reality, which we have here, wouldn't solve the moral problem. And I think that the real question is whether there were requirements in the Old Testament that would forbid anyone to marry someone who had been a prostitute. And now a priest couldn't do that. A priest couldn't marry a prostitute or someone who had been married and put away. But that was a priest, and that apparently was exceptional. And I, for myself, I can't see that there we would find any overall prohibition of this sort of thing. We would assume that whatever her past life, she had been converted, that she had mended her ways, think of Rahab, for example. So here is Rahab, and we have other examples of women who had been prostitutes, and then they are accepted into the covenant community by marriage and so on. So actually, I don't think that you could demonstrate right off that there would be a contradiction in some other legislation if, in fact, the Gomer was already a practicing prostitute and had some children as a result of this, who are therefore called the Yalde Zinonim, as if Hosea was to now have a ready-made family of the prostitute and these other children that she had by way of prostitution. So there have been these attempts to explain it away, but as I say, I don't see a problem with it at that level. And it's not to avoid the moral problem that I come to the conclusion that I do, but it's rather because I'm trying to see the parallel between Hosea's experience and what we just saw back in Deuteronomy 31 and 32, that I take the view that, no, Gomer has not been involved in prostitution. She doesn't have some children as a result of this. It's simply that just as God knew what Israel was going to do soon after the marriage, he knows what Gomer is going to do soon after this marriage, and therefore he describes her in those terms and tells Hosea to go and marry her so that his life experience will be a parable of God's relating in marriage to Israel. Yes? That's the way it works out. I think the first one is Hosea's, and the second and the third are not. And so we would be trying to find evidence both in chapter 1 and in chapter 2 that this is so. And I think there is that kind of evidence, some of it negative, some of it positive, but I think that's the picture that actually is suggested by the language here, as well as by the general comparison of Hosea's experience to the Lord's with Israel back in the days of Moses. And so I don't see any need to be talking about visions and dreams and some other non-everyday realistic understanding of this was everyday experience, a real life experience. And okay. Well, marry her, Gomer. Marry her, Hosea. Now, another question, of course, is going to be in chapter 3, when after the whatever separation, was it a divorce? That's another question. Hosea and Gomer are separated, does it actually result in a divorce? And then you come to chapter 3, as I say, is really the heart, crux of the thing. It'll be interesting to see what's going on there. But the Lord, in any case, uses very much the same language. Go, take a woman. He doesn't name her Gomer. But the question will be whether it is Gomer that he takes back there. As a matter of fact, our conclusion is there's no two ways about it. It definitely is Gomer that he takes back. And so then we get some other types of questions about the relationship of that second act in the marriage and biblical legislation. That this time, the law in Deuteronomy 24, which says that if there's a marriage and the husband puts the wife away and then she marries someone else, and that second partner either divorces her or himself dies, that then it is not proper for the first husband to take her back again. And so there is that legislation in Deuteronomy 24. And so then when we're dealing with Hosea 3, we have the question of whether, even if we have avoided a conflict with the legislation in the first chapter, we can avoid a conflict with some other legislation in chapter 3. So that's one of the things to keep in mind. And then the whole question of whether, in fact, this is just some sort of a separation that takes place, or whether during it Hosea has been married, Gomer has been married to someone else. So these are some of the questions to keep in mind as we move along here. Well, now maybe what I should do is just pause there. There's the basic situation developing, but let's just get a little quick outline of these first three chapters so that we know where we're going and what the basic structure is, and then we'll come back here and pick it up again. In each of the three chapters, we have a cycle consisting of three parts, A, B, C. The three cycles do not coincide exactly with the chapter divisions, but rather closely. These are the three cycles. And each of the three cycles consists then of three parts. And to simplify it all, and as I said, this study of Hosea is neat because it brings before us all kinds of things that we've been saying already. This consists, the first two parts, of the message of the fall of Israel, and the third part, the fullness. Okay, that we've suggested is a way of analyzing the full scope of the prophetic ministry. As lawsuits operators, they discuss the ultimate fall of Israel under a covenant of works. As heralds of the new covenant, proclaimers of the promises of the Abrahamic covenant, they are pointing to the fact that beyond the fall of Israel, there is nevertheless the full realization of God's promises with respect to the true people of God. There is the fullness of Israel, Jews and Gentiles. All right, so the first two sections then in each of these three cycles deal first with sort of the indictment and then the sentence, the sin of Israel, and then the judgment, B. All in the form of a lawsuit. In fact, when we come to chapter 2, the language of the lawsuit with the Hebrew word reeve, I don't know if we've been mentioning that word as we've talked about the lawsuit, but that actual language then emerges in our text as we move along. This is a lawsuit that he is conducting. And so he reminds them of their sin and threatens them with judgment. And yet, amazingly, abruptly, it's a surprise addition in each case. So the C section here, you hardly expect it. You've just had the worst of calamity, the fall. And then right away, he breaks into the thought of, well, that's been the old covenant, huh? Of the new covenant. And so here in these third sections of each cycle, you have a portrait of the new covenant. And as I said a few minutes ago, very useful for bringing out the way in which prophetic idiom informs prophetic accounts of the future messianic age, and we'll be taking note of that. All right. Now what we find then is that the marriage relationship of Hosea and Gomer is used to make these two points, the sin and the judgment of Israel. In the third chapter, something a little bit more than just the judgment is suggested, and we'll come to that. But primarily, the marriage relationship itself is used to depict symbolically the sinning of Israel and the calamity that will befall them. Now, along with the symbolism of the marriage relationship, there is the symbolism of the names of the children. So there's two things going on here. The children's names also bring out this whole story. And in the names of the children, they are used, each one, in a contrasting way. Jezreel, Lo Ruhamah, Lo Ami. Each of those is first used to describe the sin and judgment of Israel, especially the judgment of Israel. But in their reverse forms, they are also used to depict the fullness of Israel and the new covenant. All right, so now this is what we're going to see. And so far then, in the first cycle then, we'll cover chapter 1. And let's see, I don't know if there's a difference then in the English and the Hebrew. How many verses in the English first chapter? 11. Oh, okay. That's 11. So in the Hebrew text, the first vision, the first cycle goes through chapter 2, verse 3, huh? And that would be the equivalent of, you say 11, yeah, 8 and 3. All right, so in the Hebrew text, it goes through, the first cycle goes through chapter 2, verse 3. In your English, it's, is that the end of the chapter then in English, the 11th verse? Okay. And then the second cycle in the Hebrew text is chapter 2, and the third cycle is chapter 3. And so I assume that verse 11 is the end of chapter 1, huh? And so then chapter 2 in the English text would be the second cycle. All right. All right, now let's come back to where we were. We're in cycle 1. And already in the description of the wife as an Eshet Zinonim and the Yaldei Zinonim, we have an indication then of the sin of Israel, the covenant breaking that will be punished. And then verse 3. In response to the divine command, he went and he took the woman whose name is given as Gomer, and she is said to be the daughter of Divlaim, Watahar, and she conceived, Wateled Lo Bain, and she bore. Now this is one little clue we're going to be looking at. She bore, then the Hebrew says, Lo. The L equals 2, it's preposition, huh? And the O is the pronominal suffix, third masculine singular, so to him. So she bore to Hosea, Bain, a son. Now what we're going to notice is the absence of this when it comes to the second and the third child. She bears a second child, she bears a third child, but at least negative, and this is only negative evidence, but I think it's significant. It doesn't say that. So I take this first child to be a legitimate child of Hosea's. And she bore to him a son. And now, with the naming of this child, we move beyond sort of stage A, the sin, the unfaithfulness suggested by the very character of Hosea, of Gomer, to the judgment that's going to be visited on them. The Lord indicates what the proper names of the children should be. In verse 4, the Lord said unto me, name him Israel, Jezreel, the Greek form Esdraelon. And so we're familiar with the valley of Jezreel, the valley of Esdraelon. And now, later on, this name's going to be reversed and given its etymological sense. Etymologically, it consists of a word zara, which means to sow, and the word el, which means God. And so there's a positive thought to it going to come up afterwards. God sows, God multiplies. It's going to have reference to the way in which in the Messianic kingdom, the Gentiles all come in and multiply the people of God. But that's clearly not what's going on here. Here, Jezreel is being used not in terms of its etymological value, but in terms of an historical reference, which the text goes on to explain. Name this one Jezreel, because pretty soon, yet just a little while, and I, says the Lord, I am going to punish the blood of Jezreel upon the house of Jehu. And he continues, and I will make to cease the kingdom of the house of Israel. Back in the valley of Jezreel, Ahab had filled up the measure of his sins by killing Naboth, for which he was threatened then with judgment. And subsequently, Elisha commissions Jehu to destroy the house of Ahab, which he proceeds to do. And so Jezreel had been the site of bloodshed on the part of Ahab in the first place in killing Naboth there. And it's also then the site of subsequent judgment that Jehu visited upon the house of Ahab. Well, Jehu had obeyed God's command through Elisha in doing it, and yet subsequently Jehu is regarded as himself guilty because evidently the thought is that he himself continued in the sins of the ones whom he was punishing, so that although formally, outwardly, he was fulfilling God's command, in his heart he was sharing in the sins of the one whom he destroyed and continuing in the sins of Jeroboam, as we're told, and so on. And so he really incurred blood guiltiness, even though he was doing it at Elisha's command. So, but here is an historical occasion involving this site of Jezreel, and so God says, name him Jezreel, a place of bloodshed, guilty bloodshed, because there's going to be now punishment for that guilty blood. So that's the thought here. Name him Jezreel, a place that's redolent of blood guiltiness, and I'm going to take account of that, and I'm going to make to cease, therefore, the kingdom of the house of Israel. Mind it, not just to wipe out the dynasty of Jehu, but to wipe out the whole kingdom, the northern kingdom. The verb is hishbati. I am going to make to cease. You can hear in that hishbati the word Sabbath, shabbati. And so it is sort of punning here, and we'll see the same pun in a few other places along the line. It's punning on the concept of the Sabbath. The Sabbath, of course, can signify the cessation that ushers in rest from work, the Sabbath ordinance, the Sabbath, the day of rest, the day of consummation. But here it's sort of punned on, and it's given a sort of reverse. Yes, I will make things to cease, only it won't be labor and toil. It's going to be what will be made to cease is the existence, the very existence of the northern kingdom. So I will sabotage the northern kingdom. I will wipe it out of existence. I will make. I won't consummate it. I'll terminate it. Okay, is the play on the word there. And continuing the description now, here we're still in this B section, which is the judgment for the breaking of the covenant. In verse 5, he continues, and he says, "It shall be in that day that I will shatter," the verb is shavir, "I will shatter the bow of Israel in the valley of Jezreel." Now, apparently here, the thought is the valley of Jezreel was looked upon sort of as some sort of a line of defense, a kind of 8th century BC Maginot Line. If you remember the war where the French had their Maginot Line, it didn't prove out to be much of a defense, but that's where they were putting their confidence, and apparently that's the idea here. Israel wasn't trusting in the Lord, and this thought will be resumed and amplified presently here. They weren't trusting in the Lord to defend themselves against the alien powers and so on. Their trust was in horses and chariots and so on. Their trust was in apparently whatever defensive advantage was provided for them by this valley of Jezreel. So right there where their confidence was, they were actually going to suffer defeat. So it shall be in that day that I will shatter the bow, the military strength of Israel, there in the valley of Jezreel. All right, so there's the first child, whose name is significant then of coming disaster in recollection of blood guiltiness in the past. But verse 6 now goes on with this marriage relationship, and there's a second child. And she conceived again, with Taled, this time, not Bane, son, but Bat, daughter. So she bore a daughter, and he said to him, that is, God said to Hosea, name her, literally call her name, Lo Ruhamah, not is she pitied. You have a passive a form there, Ruhamah, not is she pitied. So we were going beyond the idea now that there's a thought that there has been blood guiltiness and there's going to be a judgment, but there will be no pity in connection with it. So it's sort of a climax as you move to the first, to the second, to the third names, and the third name, you know, being the utter rupture and disruption of the covenant, the end of the whole thing. So there will be judgment. There will be judgment without pity. And so name her Lo Ruhamah. And by the way, there, when it's picking up this point about the Lo, the first child, it said she bore a son to him. And now notice that this time in verse 6, it simply says that she conceived and she bore a daughter, but it doesn't say to him. And so I think here's the first clue that this was an illegitimate child, and this, along with the third one. And that explains the opening reference then to the fact that he was to marry a woman of whoredoms and also to have Yalde Zinonim, children of whoredoms. And here's one of them, I think. So name her then, not pitied. And the explanation, Lord adds, is because not will I literally add again that I should have mercy or pity upon the house of Israel. So whatever patience God had shown through the years in postponing the judgment, there will be no more of that. And of course, this is the 8th century, and by the end of the 8th century, 722, there was no more delay in judgment. There was no more mercy. For I will not have pity again or further upon the house of Israel, that I should at all, literally the Hebrew word is the verb nasah, which means to lift up, and it has reference to the lifting up, taking away of sins. So I will not have mercy upon them any more than I should at all forgive their sins. So here was this works arrangement, and they had broken the covenant, and now there will be, in terms of this covenant, there is no forgiveness for them. There's only going to be exile. And of course, that's a way of describing what this judgment is. In all three B sections, the judgment is ultimately that of exile, just as Moses back in Deuteronomy threatened. That would be the ultimate outcome of covenant breaking, would be the foreign nation would come and take God's people away. Verse 7 is sort of an interruption in the flow of things. Now, this has all been about Israel, mind you. Here Hosea is sent to the northern kingdom of Israel, and all of this has been about the northern kingdom. But there's Judah down there in the south. And verse 7, in the midst of all of this description of the judgment of the Old Covenant community sort of anticipates what we're going to get in the sea portion of the thing, and in a little bit another horizon beyond the fall, a new age, a better covenant, an age of a covenant that cannot be broken, thinking again of Jeremiah 31:31, a covenant that will be characterized by the forgiveness of sins. And so the light of that prospect sort of breaks into this announcement of judgment, and it's associated with Judah. It's associated with the place where there is on the throne of God a descendant of David, where the promised king of the Abrahamic covenant is being typically portrayed in the line of David, which has received its own special Davidic covenant guaranteeing that it will issue at last in the greater son of David, whose throne will be forever and who will build God's house. And so in Judah to the south, there was something else that was happening. There was the genuine messianic hope rising up out of the Abrahamic promises that was there and that was being honored and that was represented by a descendant of David. And it wasn't there confidence in the military things. It was confidence in the God who was the God of this throne of David that came to expression there. And I think that's what's going on in verse 7. I'm going to judge Israel, but then he says, but as for the house of Judah, I will have pity upon them. Israel, lo ruchama. Israel, lo ruchama. I will not have pity upon them. But Judah, where the throne of David is and from whom, where Messiah is going to come, I will have pity upon them. There the underlying Abrahamic covenant comes to expression, as I keep saying in my analysis of the Abrahamic, of the Mosaic covenant. Even though at the upper typological level there is worse, underlying that there is the principle of grace, the Abrahamic covenant, and this seventh verse reminds us of that. In the midst of these judgments, in terms of the Mosaic covenant, God still is remembering his messianic promises. And so he says, as for the house of Judah, I will have pity upon them, and I will save them. I'll save them not by their own strength, but I will save them by Yahweh Elohim, by Yahweh their God. The thought is that they are putting their trust not in the bow and not in the valley of Jezreel, as Israel was doing. They are putting their trust in the Lord their God, and God will honor that faith, and he will save them. I will not save them by the bow and by the sword and by war and by horses and the chariots, the kind of thing Israel puts its confidence in. No, I'm going to save them by the God in whom we trust. So verse 7 breaks in sort of parenthetically as a message of hope in the midst of judgment. And so when we do come to this last section, it isn't quite as abrupt as it would be otherwise. Verse 7 has anticipated this other note. But then it quickly moves back in verse 8 to the thought of the judgment of Israel and the third child. And you got a very realistic note. It says, and when she had weaned, lo ruchama, the second child, then she conceived, and she bore another son. Once again, the to him is missing, so I take it that this third one also is not Hosea's child. She bears another one, a son. And verse 9, and he said, that is, God said, name this one Lo Ami. And of course, that is the ultimate in judgment. That's the end of the whole covenant relationship, the covenant bond that made Israel my people. And God says, I am their God, they are my people. That's it, that's over. They are no longer my people. They are like one of those foolish people that we saw in Moses, that God obtaining between the two in terms of that second level. It is disrupted. It's resumed afterwards for a while. And then, of course, in 70 AD, it's applied once again with finality, and so that lo ami then marks the final total end of that typological works order. Fortunately, as verse 7 reminded us, something else is still in place and intact, and this fall of Israel, simply in the amazing wisdom of God, proves to be the occasion when the fullness of Israel can be realized in spite of the fall of Israel. So, but meanwhile, then, this is the end of that relationship until God then establishes it for an interim period until 70 AD. And so name this one Lo Ami, for you are not my people anymore. And I, Lo Ehye Lakem. Right, the Hebrew then reads, and as for me, I, Lo, it's a negative. Then there's the verb Haya, which means to be, and the imperfect first singular. Not will I be to you, and I, not will I be to you. So it sounds as if something is missing. We know what the idea is. You are not my people. I am not your God. And so some suggest that by rearranging the Hebrew consonants, we should read it, and I, not will I be your God. We would read Elohikem instead of Ehyelikem. But there are various other ways of explaining it. The verb hayak, instead of just meaning to be, can have the force of to be active, to be present, to act. God is not just the one who is, but he is there for us. He is not a God far off, but he is one who is there in our need. And in fact, when God is giving his name to Moses, Moses wants to know what's in his name, and you get the name Yahweh, Yehasher, which is related to this. I think that's the basic force of it there, that God is committing himself to be not a God far off, but I am the one who is actively there for you, acting as your God. As a matter of fact, another way of taking this is not as a verb, but as the actual name of God. And as for me, not Ehyeh will I be any. Not will I be Yahweh to you anymore. The name of God. I will not be what that name indicates to you. So there's a variety of ways of taking it, but the sense is plain to everyone. You are not my people. I am not your God. Lo ami. The covenant's over. So that's the end of the picture of judgment. And then abruptly, I say abruptly, except that we had a little clue in verse 7 that something else was going on in Judah leading up to Christ. Well, what was going on there finally happens, and Christ finally comes, and there's a new day that dawns, and there's a new covenant that is established. And all of a sudden here in verse 2, we have that new covenant age being described in prophetic idiom, described in terms of all kinds of experiences that the Israelites had. And I think what we'll find now as we proceed through each of these third sections, in the first, the second, and the third cycles, and you put them all together, and what you get is that Hosea has rehearsed pretty much the whole history of Israel and at all kinds of points all along the line, from the Exodus to the wilderness experience to the settlement and conquest in the land to the United Kingdom and so on to the restoration from exile. He exploits the whole history of Israel to find illustrations at every point along the line for what Christ is going to do in terms of saving sinners out of all of the world. So that hermeneutically, you're trying to be a literalist, the way the dispensationalists would handle this. And, you know, they would like to just limit things to the idea, to the image of the tribes coming back from their dispersion to the promised land and say, well, that's referring to what happened in 1948 or will be happening of literal Jews coming back to the land of Palestine. But, you know, if that's your hermeneutic, then what you're also going to have to say is you have to treat all of these things literally, and you're going to have to say that in the future there's going to be an exodus out of Egypt of the Jews, and there's going to be a wandering through the wilderness and a new settlement of the land and a new united monarchy and an exile. You'd have to for consistency's sake, you'd have to say that the whole thing must be treated literally. But if the whole thing isn't going to be treated literally, there's no point in just saying that one illustration, the return from exile, should be treated literally. So that's something to be bearing in mind here. Well, let's look at chapter 2 then, or in your English, it's apparently chapter 1, verse 9. Okay. Now he has just said, the kingdom ceases, you're not my people. Now all of a sudden he says, it shall be that the number of the children of Israel will be like the sand of the sea. Now, here's your Abrahamic covenant. That's the language of the Abrahamic promises, that God will multiply Abraham and Sarah's descendants so that they will be as numerous as the dust, as the stars, as the sand of the sea. And so definitely here is Hosea doing what we said the prophets do. They proclaim the promises of the Abrahamic covenant and point to their fulfillment, and he uses the language of the Abrahamic covenant. And so they will be like the sand of the sea, which lo yamad, which cannot be measured, will lo yisafir, and which cannot be numbered. So the multiplying of the people. Now we're what are the Abrahamic promises? So, well, there's the king, and there's the people, and there's the land. God promises a kingdom to Abraham. King, people, and land. And here we're going to find that those several elements are all reflected upon, including the thought here of the people, the numerous people as a matter of fact. And that thought was suggested then if you take the name Jezreel, and instead of looking at it as a recollection of the historical episodes of guilty bloodshedding back in the valley of Jezreel, and if instead of doing that you take the name and give it its etymological value, God sows, then that's what is happening here. We're beginning to get the reversed meaning of the name of the first child, Jezreel, expressive of the promise of the multiple people of God under the new covenant. And it shall be that in the place where it was said to them, you are not my people, it will be said to them, B'nei El Chai, you are the children of the living God. So there's the name of the third child that is brought into the picture. And verse 2 in the Hebrew chapter 2, and your verse 10, I guess, huh? It would be, and the children of Judah will be gathered together, and the children of Israel, the idea of togetherness is emphasized by the word yachdav, and they will place for themselves, or appoint for themselves, Rosh Echad, one head, one leader, and they will go up from the land, for great is the day of Jezreel. So they're still playing with the name Jezreel as a prophecy of blessing. And the New Covenant blessings or kingdom are depicted in terms of that ideal situation of the as yet undivided monarchy. You think of the days of David and Solomon, when all of the tribes of Israel had given their allegiance unitedly together in that one kingdom to the occupant of the Davidic throne. So here is a picture of the new covenant, not using return from exile to portray it, but using just the peaceful, unified situation of the United Kingdom to portray it. They will be gathered together, Judah and Israel, as one people, and that they will appoint for themselves as one leader. They won't have a divided kingdom with one king here and one king there and so on. But there will just be this Rosh Echad, one leader. And, of course, that leader is Christ, the head of the church. And they will go up from the land, for great is the day of Jezreel. All right, they will go up from the land, another little expression that has been treated in a variety of ways. What does that mean? They will go up from the land. Now you see, we're looking into the Old Testament, its history and so on, to try to find some situation that would be employed here to depict the messianic salvation and the kingdom. They will go up from the land. Well, right away, one thing that occurs to you is the Exodus, huh? So that now we are back to that point in the history, that they will go up out of the land of Egypt. And as a matter of fact, in chapter 2, in the Hebrew, in verse 17, and in the English, that would be around verse 14, is it? Where there's a reference to the land of Egypt, and you can find it in around 2:14 in the English. Is there something about going up from the land of Egypt there? In the Hebrew, it's in which is it?
15,
okay. So you're in your English text, chapter 2, verse 15, and your Hebrew text, chapter 2, verse 17, it doesn't just speak about going up from the land, but it speaks about going up from the land, and then it adds the word Egypt. So there's a pretty powerful argument that back in the verse we're dealing with, going up from the land is Exodus imagery. But there have been a lot of other explanations. Some say it means going up from the land of Assyria, as if it were, once again, the thought of dispersion, exile, and they're going up from the land of Assyria. Others take the word Haaretz, land, as a reference to the Sheol, the grave, and it is used sometimes the word Eretz for the underworld. And so it'd be a thought of sort of resurrection. Others take just for the thought of productivity. They will go up from the land like plants which are sprouting up from the land. It would be emphasizing again the name Jezreel, that God will multiply them. And so there's a whole variety of ways in which this particular phrase has been construed. So you can survey them and take your choice. So they will go up from the land, and great is the day of Jezreel. And now verse 3 reflects once again on the names Lo-Ami and Lo-Rukama and gives them their reverse, their blessing significance. Say to your brothers, now when Christ comes, then you'll be able to say to your brothers, and to you are my people, and say to your sisters, Rukama, beloved now. So the negative judgments have been reversed. And the blessings of the Abrahamic covenant, especially the multiplying of the people of God, are emphasized here. All right, that's the end of the first cycle. And let's see, break time? Is it? Yeah, I guess it is. That'd be a good place to take. Three cycles now, and we've gone through one of them. And we've seen how they deal with the Mosaic covenant broken in section A, and in section B with the judgment curse of the Mosaic covenant, and then in the third section they deal with the new covenant. Same thing now we're going to find in chapter 2. It's a longer chapter, and I do want to get through the three chapters here tonight, and so on. You know, I might be talking even faster than normal in plowing ahead through chapter 2, but you see the general structure of the thing, and it's going to be just details are varying. Let me give you a little outline, however, of the way it works out now in chapter 2. I'll be giving you the verses in the Hebrew. And so in your English, whatever, you'll have to reduce it by two or three verses, is it? Okay. The A section in chapter 2 is verses 4 through 7. So here's the broken covenant. It's a complaint. It's a warning. It's an indictment. Verses 4 through 7. And then we move on to verses 8 through 15.
How?
For the B section, right? B section is 8 through 15. And there you get the threat of the judgment, the actual sentence of judgment against them. Covenant judgment. And then the third section is verses 16 through 25, where you have sort of an oath of restoration, a new covenant. And maybe right away in in verses 8 through 15, which is the B portion of this. It breaks down into verses 8 through 10, where the thought is, and it's a judgment now, the removal from Baalism. Removal, the people of God are going to be removed from Baalism. That's what they have been delighting in through these years. They've been married to the Lord, but they've been taking delight in their in the Baal cult. And so by way of judgment now, God threatens that then he's going to prevent their continuing alliance with Baal. He's going to frustrate them in their attempts to continue in that. And so the theme of the removal of Baalism here has that negative thing of frustrating their desires. And then verses 11 through 15, it's the removal of their prosperity. So the removal of Baalism and then the removal of prosperity. The paragraphing of this, the breaking up in the separate sections, is rather clearly signalized to us in the Hebrew. Each new section begins with lakain, which has the force of truly, verily. It, of course, can mean therefore, but it's also used to introduce a solemn affirmation, like when Jesus would say, verily, verily, I say unto you. Well, here would be about the equivalent of that lakain, verily, truly. And so you get that in verse 8, you get that in verse 11, and it helps you to see the structure of the passage. And then you get it once more at the beginning of this next major section, the C section, which extends from 16 through 25. And here will be a picture then of the new covenant and its blessings. And interestingly, it echoes these two themes. By way of judgment, there was going to be the removal of Baalism, the removal of prosperity. By way of blessing, once again, surprisingly, there's going to be the removal of Baalism, but in a completely different sense. Up there, the removal of Baalism was frustrating them in their attempts to get back to the cult of Baal. Here under the new covenant blessings, the removal of Baalism isn't a matter of frustration, but of purgation. It's going to be a cleansing of them. The removal of Baalism is conceived of in that way. And then secondly, there will be a restoration of prosperity. So the thing is all structured, as I say, by this introductory term in verses 8, 11, and 16, and by the repetition of these various ideas. Well, with that much of the overall outline, let's quickly read through the text. Verse 4. Here is that word reeve that we talked about, the lawsuit. The command now is given, contend with your mother. Here the children are told to conduct a lawsuit, as it were, with their mother. Contend with your mother. Yes, contend with her. For she is not my wife, and I am not her husband. Or contend with her that she will not be my wife, and I will not be her husband. This is a threat. We're in a stage of the game here in these opening verses where the judgment is being threatened. In a moment, we'll see, tell her to do this lest something else happens. So the thought there is that the judgment conceivably could be averted, lest something happens. And so I take it that these opening verses are more in the tentative form that I will put her away, that I will divorce her. So contend with your mother. Yes, contend with her that, you know, continuing in the present course, she will no longer be my wife and I will not be her husband anymore. By the way, notice the use in the Hebrew of the word ish, which means man in the more specific sense of husband. And that will be an important point when we come to chapter 3, the difficult crux of the whole thing. And then moving on. So contend with her to this effect. Yes, urge her that she should turn her adulteries from her face and her fornications from between her breasts, lest I should strip her naked and set her forth as in the day that she was born. Now you get some imagery that was actually used in connection with divorce cases, and we talked about this, I think, when we were talking about Adam and Eve and the theme of divorce and nakedness in Genesis 3, and we made the point that it was actually a form of legal notification that someone was being thrust out, that the reprehensible party was being thrust out, was to thrust them forth naked. And so that's the threat that God is making here to depict the threat of divorce. Lest I strip her naked and set her forth as in the day in which she was born. And then you get some other imagery to describe the threatened judgments. And lest I should make her like a wilderness and make her like a desert land. So the idea of unfruitfulness and desolation is pictured in terms of this impersonal imagery of turning her into a desert. And then the impersonal imagery becomes personal again when he adds, and lest I slay her with thirst. So instead of saying that she will be turned into the desert, then the thought is that she will be turned into someone who is perishing in the desert from thirst. But the threat of judgment. And let's see, we said which verses, verses 4 through 7. And upon her children. Now here we get back to the use of the children's names as indicative of judgment. And upon her children I will not have pity, lo ruhama, for they are the children of whoredoms. Okay, now notice in chapter 1 we said a clue to the fact that the second and the third children were not legitimately Hosea's was the absence of that word to him. Now here we are in the second chapter where we're working on the name of the second child, Lo Ruhama, and it's in connection with that one that we get the thought for these are children of whoredoms. So I think here's another clue then that supports our approach, that they are the children of whoredoms. Verse 7, for their mother committed whoredom, unfaithfulness. The one who bore them acted shamefully, discussing, as I said, the second and the third children, acted shamefully. For she said, I will go after my lovers, the ones who gave me my bread and my water, Zamri, Pishti, my wool and my flax, my oil and my drink, my beverage. Now what we have here then is the picture of a wife who has been faithfully cared for by her husband, who has provisioned her with all of the usual necessities. And she has received that. Instead of thanking him, she says, oh, these are the things that I have from my lovers with whom I have been committing unfaithfulness against my husband. And so it's perverse in gratitude. And the list of things that are mentioned here include food and clothing and oil. And it so turns out that in legal texts from the ancient Near East, where it is prescribing the duties of a man toward various secondary wives, that there is a triad of commodities that are always stipulated as constituting what a husband provides for his wife. And they are these three: food, clothing, and oil. Oil, presumably, for its multiple values and functions as medicinal and cosmetic and also energy, but very much needed something, and so it was included in the legal description of what must be done for wives. And so here, these are the elements that the Lord has been the faithful husband. He's been providing the usual standard conventional provisions and Israel perversely has been attributing them to someone else. And now then we come, that's the end of that section, which describes their sin, and within which then there are threats. So the punishment is described as what will follow upon the sin. And now we come, however, to a section where it is not the sin that is the center of the thing, but it's the punishment. And verse 8 then begins with that word, lakain. Therefore, verily, verily, behold, I am going to hedge up her ways with thorns, and I'm going to build her a wall against her. Now, the thought is that she's hankering to go running down the path to the Baal cult rituals, but God is going to frustrate her. So we said the removal of Baalism, huh, is a punishment here, a removal of Baalism in the sense of frustration. She can't do what she wants to do because the Lord will block up the way so that she will not be able to find her paths anymore, as verse 8 concludes. Then he goes on in verse 19, and she will pursue after her lovers, and she won't be able to overtake them. And she will seek, but she won't find. And then we get this interesting little reaction on her part. And she will say, then, in the midst of all of this frustration and trouble, she will say, I will go and I will return El Ish HaRishon unto... Now here, again, is the word Ish in the sense of a husband, huh? Not just man. I will return unto my husband, HaRishon, as it was at the first, Ki tov li az me'ata, because I was better off then than I am now, because it was better then than it is now. Now here there's a little question that has some bearing on the question of whether she actually, Gomer, was actually divorced not only, or separated, but had married someone else. This word HaRishon could be translated, I will go and I will return unto my first husband. And that would imply then that there had been a second husband. But what I'm saying is that it isn't necessary to take it as an adjective describing the idea of husband, my first husband, but it could be taken more adverbially. I am going to go back to my husband as it was at the first, when I was better off than I am now. And I think that that second clause supports the adverbial idea that's referring to that time and this time rather than a first husband and a second husband. So from this particular verse, I don't think you can establish that she had remarried. Just in that connection, before I forget it, the idea that there could have been a separation and an actual divorce is altogether possible if you can keep a finger in there and turn to Jeremiah 3. These opening chapters of Jeremiah ought to be studied in connection with the Hosea passage. I don't know if I'm going to be able to put my finger right on the exact verses I want, but let's see. In Jeremiah 3, the opening verse moves in the same area of thought we were dealing with. If a man divorces his wife and she leaves him and marries another man, now here's a quotation then from the Deuteronomy 24 prohibition. Should he return to her again, would not the land be completely defiled? But you have lived as a prostitute with many lovers. Would you now return to me, declares the Lord? So that would seem to say that, no, the Lord would not take them back after that. And yet as you move along, if I can find it now, let's look around verse 8. Because Israel's immorality mattered so little to her, she defiled the land and committed adultery with stone and wood. In spite of all this, her unfaithful sister Judah did not return to me with all her heart, but only in pretense, declares the Lord. I'm looking for verse, someone can help me, where he says he would, will receive her back. Let's look up at verse 8. I gave faith. Oh, here's one that I wanted. I gave faithless Israel her certificate of divorce and sent her away because of all her adulteries and so forth. And yet, where is the verse where he says he will receive them back? Yeah, around 13. Yeah, 14. Thank you. Verse 14. Yet in spite of that I gave her a certificate of divorce and sent her away, yet, verse 14, return, faithless people, declares the Lord, for I am your husband. I will choose one of you from every town and two from every clan and bring you to Zion. And we get language here that seems to be describing the new covenant and God's taking back of his people. So in making up your mind about what's going on in Hosea 2, you want to read Jeremiah 3 as well. Yes. Is that first? That's fine. Yeah, that may be there is, but it's perfectly valid way of doing it. And as I say, the next clause seems to support that thought, because she says then and now. She puts it in terms of time, then and now. I was better off then than I am now. So that's the argument for that, and then I think that may well be the right interpretation. Now, what verse was that again? I'm back in I'm back in Hosea 2, and verse 9 in the Hebrew text, verse 9, for I was better off then than now. And verse 10, because she did not know or acknowledge that I was the one who gave to her the grain and the wine and the oil, and then the silver I multiplied to her and the gold which she used for Baal. So there was this perverse refusal of Israel to acknowledge that the Lord is her provider, and she took his good gifts and she dedicated them to the god Baal. All right, that's verses 8 through 10, the removal of Baalism, the judgment, and along with it an explanation of why the judgment. Now verses 11 through 15 is going to be the theme of the removal of prosperity. And let's read through it quickly. Verily, I will return and I will take back my grain in its season and my wine in its time. And I will snatch away the wool and the flax, the kasot, which was to have been a covering for her nakedness. So God had been providing the food, he'd been providing the wherewithal of clothing and oil, and they refused to acknowledge him as the source, and therefore, as an act of judgment, he will remove all these things from them. And verse 12, and now I will expose her lewdness before the eyes of her lovers, and no one will be able to deliver from my hand. And verse 13, and here we get that pun again on the verb Shabbat, Sabbath. The idea is going to be reversed, not consummation, but termination. And so God says, Wehishbati, I am going to make to cease, I'm going to Sabbatize all of her joyful feasts, and it mentions the annual ones and the monthly ones and the daily ones. I'm all of her festivals, the annual festival, the new moon, and the Sabbath itself. That's interesting. The verb is Sabbath and the object is Sabbath. I'm going to Sabbath the Sabbath. I'm going to make to cease the Sabbath celebration. And then summing it up, all of her festivals God's going to take away. And I'm going to make desolate her vine and fig tree, which she said, oh, these are the things that the higher for me, which my lovers gave to me. And I will turn these things into thickets, and the beasts of the field will devour them. So here's the land of milk and honey, this paradise land being turned into a desolation as God's act of judgment upon them. And the reason for it, verse 15, I'm going to punish her for what's called here the days of Baal. What are the days of Baal? It's the cultic days when the Baal devotees were gathering for their licentious worship and so on. And the Israelites joined in that, and so God will punish them for their involvement in these festal cultic days of Baal, unto whom she burned incense. And she decked herself all out with rings and jewels, and she went after her lovers, and me she quite forgot, says the Lord. So you keep getting this interweaving of the sin, which is the cause of the judgment, and the judgment which follows. And in the first section, it was the emphasis was on the sin, and then in the second section, the emphasis is on the judgment. Okay. And now abruptly, but happily, we get beyond the fall of Israel, which has just been described, and we come now to verses 16 through 25, which are this C section for this second cycle. And here again, our interest is to see in the way in which the whole history of Israel is drawn upon, episodes here and there and everywhere, in order to portray the blessings of the Messianic kingdom and the new marriage that will take place. It begins then with this word, lakain, again, as we said, verily. Now, verily, behold, I am mipatecha, means I am coaxing, persuading, alluring, wooing, her, the verb pata here. We had the verb pata back in the Noahic oracle in the sense of to open, make God open wide the tents of Shem so the Japhethites can come pouring in. There's another root, pata here, which, as I said, means coax, persuade, or to allure. So it's God of wooing his bride here under the new covenant. This is the thought. I'm going to persuade her, allure her, and I will bring her forth into the midbar, into the wilderness. Now, as part of a positive picture of blessing, what does midbar, wilderness connote? Up above, we had the threat that God's going to turn her as an act of judgment into a midbar, into a wilderness, a desolate place. But now here, the thought is one of blessing, and so it can't be wilderness as suggestive of desolation. But in the history of Israel, then, what does the wilderness suggest when we think of the Israelites in Exodus and God says, let my son go that they may enter into the wilderness. And the wilderness here is Sinai, the place of trysting, of covenant engagement and so on, of covenant making at Sinai. That's what the wilderness here is. So God is alluring her into the place of covenant making, of mutual avowal that's going to take place as it did at Sinai. So I will allure her, and I will bring her into the wilderness. And literally it says, and I will speak unto her heart. I will speak unto her heart for an interesting illustration of the force of that expression. The passage in Judges 19, 1 through 3, which is the one where the Levite, how many times did you preach on that recently there, Pastor?
Judges 3? 19.
So the Levite, huh? So the Levite goes, his wife has gone back to her father, huh? And the Levite goes and he is wanting to persuade her to come back home with him. And this is the expression that's used here. He spoke to her heart. He argued as persuasively as he could for her to do that. And so here's the Lord dealing with his people to bring them into a marriage relationship to him. And I gave to her her vineyards from there. Now, I said, I'm going to bring her into the wilderness. And you think of the history of Israel now, and we get a series of pictures the way in which the New Testament is so far going to surpass the Old Testament, even to the point of turning its curses into blessings. And so as they wandered through the wilderness beyond Sinai and so on, of course, it wasn't a place that was a land flowing with milk and honey. And the ones who went into the land came back with these big clusters of grapes and so on. But that wasn't the way things were in the wilderness. You had to get up with there into the land of Canaan to find all of that stuff. But here God says, under the new covenant, such will be the fertility and productivity of the Messianic kingdom, that even in the wilderness they will have their vineyards already. So I will give her then her vineyards from there already in the wilderness. And even a more astounding reversal is this business of the Valley of Achor. And the Valley of Achor I'm going to turn into a Petach Tikva, which means a door of hope. Now, what happened in the Valley of Achor? Well, that was the place of judgment, huh? That's where Achan and his family were destroyed because of their sins. So the Valley of Achor is the place where God's judgment strikes. Now, under the new covenant, such is the marvelous grace of God that the place where God's judgment strikes becomes the door of hope, the cross of Calvary, huh? Where God's judgment strikes becomes the opening of the door of grace and of tikvah, of hope. So it's really a beautiful way of describing the blessedness, the where grace more abounds under the new covenant. And then this continues with the thought that she will, the Hebrew verb is ana, which can mean either to answer or to sing, to answer or to sing. So let's try out both possibilities. She will answer me there as in the days of her youth, as in the day of her coming up, may Eretz Mitzrayim. Now there's the expression that we suggested might throw some light on that earlier phrase, coming up from the land. Here it throws on the word Egypt, which would here at least be definitely Exodus imagery. And so there's a harking back now to God's dealings with Israel, something that happened there in connection with the Exodus that will be picked up under the Messianic covenant. She will answer me there as in the days of her youth. Remember, we said that in certain passages when it's thinking just on the initiation stage of this relationship, that there's the honeymoon stage before the sin takes over. Another way in which it is put in Jeremiah again is that this first stage is her youth. So some innocence of youth still there. But it's that first stage, right after the Exodus. What took place soon thereafter that could be spoke of as her answering or as her singing? If it's her singing, one would think of something like Exodus 15, when they come out of the land of Egypt and then they have the song of Miriam or the song of Moses or the song of the sea, the celebration of the salvation victory of God over the Pharaoh and his chariots and so on. And so the new covenant will be marked by a similar rejoicing and celebration and hymning of the praises of God's salvation. If you translate the word ana in the other way, instead of singing, that it's answer me, then our thoughts might go from Exodus 15 and the song of celebration to Exodus 20 through 24, the covenant ratification at Sinai, which the wilderness prepared for, where there was a mutual avowing, you are mine, I am yours. Huh? She will answer me there as she answered in the days of her youth. And in the next verse, I think maybe throw some light on that choice. In verse 18, it goes on to say, it shall be in that day, says the Lord, that you will call me Ishi, my husband, and not will you call me anymore Baali, after the name of Baal. But the thought that verse 18 says, you will call me, you will avow me, you will acknowledge me as your husband, maybe supports the understanding of the Ana back in verse 17, as you will answer me there. I will say, you are my wife, and she will say to me, you are my husband. But the picture we're getting then is one of this engagement, this betrothal, this nuptial engagement and commitment of the one to the other, the making of the covenant relationship in Christ. Now verse 19, the blessings of the Messianic Kingdom are spoken of in terms of the removal of Baalism. As we said, the removal of Baalism in the judgment section connoted frustration. She will not be allowed to continue in the worship of Baal. Here, the removal of Baalism is one of purgation. It's the cleansing them of their idolatry.
Going back just to make sure I'm clear, in terms of the picture of answering, it would go back, you said, to Exodus 24. I'm assuming you're referring to it when the people answered and said with one voice that all the words that the Lord has said we will do, that their indication that they will
that would be a precise focus, but I guess I was also thinking more generally. The whole mutual covenant-making commitment went to the other. But the verse you're speaking about is certainly the most explicit one where Israel makes their commitment, right? Now in verses 16 through 25, we come to a new section in verse 21, which is here marked by the triple... repetition of the word va'erashtika, which means I will betroth her. So the actual betrothing is underscored here now. And this, as it's repeated three times, va'erashtika li, I will betroth her to myself, the olam, forever. Now this will not again be an old covenant type of works arrangement that could be broken. This is one which is one of sovereign grace in Christ, which is forever. And then it repeats, yes, I will betroth her to myself in Zedek and Mishpat. It just heaps up every conceivable term that would bring out the steadfastness, the idea of fulfillment and fidelity that we can possibly imagine. So forever in righteousness and in judgment and in loving kindness and in mercies. And then the third time, Erashtika in verse 22 in the Hebrew text, yes, I will betroth her to myself in emunah, like from the word amen, which also brings out this steadfastness. And verse 22 ends up with the thought, and you will, and the verb is know again, acknowledge, confess, you will know the Lord. Here again, then, is the thought that she will answer me and confess her covenantal allegiance, her marriage allegiance to the Lord's. So here is the church making its commitment to the Lord Christ. Now let's see, that's verse 23. It shall be in that day. All right, now we've had the removal of Baalism. We've had the thought of the marriage engagement. And now we have the thought of the return of prosperity. Instead of the removal of prosperity, which was the threat, now there's the return of prosperity. And let's see what it says. It shall be in that day, that says the Lord, that I will answer, yes, I will answer the heavens. So the heavens are pictured as asking God for something, and God gives it to them. And then they, the heavens, will answer the earth, because the earth has been asking the heavens for something, and now the heaven is able to give it. And then the earth will answer the grain and the wine and the oil, because these have been looking to the earth for something, and now the earth is able to give it. And then it is summed up by saying, and they will answer Jezreel. Now what you have is sort of a prayer chain turned upside down, and it begins here with Jezreel. Here are the people of God. And so it's as if they are praying to the land, as it were, to provide them with the grain and the wine and the oil. And the land can't do that unless the heavens provide them with the moisture. So this prayer chain continues with the land praying to the heavens, provide us with moisture. But then the heavens can't provide the earth with moisture unless the Lord precipitates the thing and triggers the thing. And so the heavens are pictured as the end of the prayer chain now, asking for the Lord himself to trigger them. So it's this chain of command from God down to Israel, the net result of which is that God provides the rain and thus the products to provide the blessings that the people of God are asking him for it's a time of blessedness. And it's playing again with the name Jezreel. Now in its etymological meaning, Jezreel, made up of the two words Zarah to sow and El God, and so it's bringing out the thought that the Messianic kingdom then will be one of productivity, fertility, universality. And continuing with that punning on the name Jezreel, and using the very verb Zarah, verse 25 says, "And I will sow her to myself in the land." So there's the pun on Jezreel. "And I will have mercy," and here's the pun on Lo Ruhamah, the reversal of not will she be pitied to I will pity, "and I will have pity upon Lo Ruhamah, and I will say to Lo Ami," and here's the third child, "and I will say to Lo Ami, my people you are, and she will say, my God." So all the names of the children have been reversed to bring out the thought of blessing, and it climaxes in the thought again of a marriage commitment, each one committing, God, you are my people, the people, you are my God. And that brings us to the end of the second cycle. And again, as you've seen then, with all kinds of points in the history of Israel used in order to portray by prophetic idiom the corresponding messianic blessings. Now let's get into this the third chapter. It's a short one, but it's in a way the most difficult. The same three sections, A, B, C. First section, pointing to the sin that causes the trouble. "The Lord said unto me, go again, love a woman, beloved of Reah," all right, I'm taking it as meaning her husband, and this is a valid meaning of this particular word, husband. It can also mean a friend, and so some say a paramour instead of her husband, a beloved of some paramour someplace. And others, in fact, then change the pointing of the word Reah, which means husband or lover, and point at Ra, which means evil, and change also the pointing of the verb from a passive, beloved by, to loving, and so some just translate love a woman who loves evil. No reason for making those changes. And I'm favoring the view that the Rea here is her husband. That's the picture. It's the only one that fits because, as it goes on to explain, your experience, Hosea, is such as is modeled after mine. And God, of course, loved the woman who, though she was loved by him, was unfaithful. And so in the case of Hosea, I think that demonstrates rather clearly here that this woman whom he is to take back is Gomer, who had been faithfully loved and cared for by Hosea, but who had been unfaithful through him. And so I would translate, go now and love this woman who is beloved by you, her husband, and yet she's been unfaithful to you. But don't let that stop you, Hosea. Go and take her back. Even as the Lord loves the children of Israel, even though they are turning unto other gods and are loving these cakes of raisins, which apparently are something connected with the fertility cult. So the picture, I think, is plain. And the woman that he takes back just must be Gomer, because otherwise what he's being told to do is go and take a woman who is loved by her husband, some other guy, some poor fellow who loves her and is faithful to her, and she's sinning against him. And now you, Hosea, go and join in the sin by marrying her and offending against her true husband. And no way that was the Lord was about to tell Hosea to do that. And so the only way to avoid that is to understand that Hosea himself is the one who is the husband who has loved her and against whom she has been unfaithful. So that's the picture that we get. And so take her back. But meanwhile, then, point A, the sin. And now the judgment. And here's where the difficulty, here's where the interesting thing, here's where the crux of the whole thing appears. Now, we're in the section that calls for a description of judgment. Exile. And yet here in here in this third section, here in this third cycle, the theme of judgment and exile is symbolized by all things by reunion. That's the puzzler. What's going on here? Be reunited with this wife as a symbol of judgment. How to explain this? This is the real puzzle of the whole matter. Well, let's look at it a little further. Huh? Verse 2 is Hosea's obedience. And in the Hebrew, there's a verb nakar, which is used here, which has the force of to gain legal right over, or to assume one's legal rights to someone. And the picture seems to be then that in this separation from Hosea, Gomer has somehow been involved in some kind of indebtedness, where she has contracted some legal obligations to someone somehow that Hosea has to honor or redeem in order to take her back and to assert his own legal authority over her. But that is what is suggested by this verb. So there has been this separation, but now he establishes his husbandly authority in this situation, and he gets her back, however we are to picture her indebtedness or whatever mess she had got herself into here. He then sort of redeems her from that as a way of reestablishing the marriage authority relationship once again. And so I did this, and for a price. The price is described in terms of 15 pieces of silver, omer measure of barley, and then this puzzling latex barley, which no one knows for sure what it means. Maybe some other kind of a measure of barley, or maybe a liquid measure of some kind. Some price then that he is paying in order to assert his relationship to her again. And what is that relationship now, this reunion? And why do I say that it is a reunion which somehow is descriptive of separation? Huh? Well, that's what exile is separation. And why would a reunion be used to symbolize that? And yet that's what the text proceeds to say. Now let's look more closely here. In verse 3, Hosea begins to explain, what is this relationship now, Gomer, that we're going to have with one another? And I said to her, Yamim Rabim, for many days, Teshavi, the Hebrew verb yashav, which can mean to live, to dwell, to continue. Another suggestion is to mean to wait for. And then li, to me. Now back in verse 2 it says, I secured the rights over, for myself. I took her to myself. I gained legal relationship to her, to me. I brought her into this relationship to me. And now that expression, marriage relationship of sorts, you will not commit prostitution anymore the way you did before. Moreover, the way I would read the next verse, where it simply says, "Velo tihi le'ish," it's another example of that word ish I've been trying to underscore as we've worked along, where ish means husband. And you will not be to your husband. So there's going to be a marriage, a reunion, but you will not be to your husband. And then it concludes with the phrase, and also I to you. The Hebrew words are all little words easily to translate in themselves, but what the sense of them is really puzzling. There are so many possibilities. And let me suggest to you where I end up with this. I said unto her, for many days now, you're going to continue then with me. There's going to be this official marriage, and within which you won't be unfaithful. You won't have the opportunity to do that. But on the other hand, this marriage will not be consummated. It won't be normal marriage in that sense, because you will not be to your husband. And then as for me, I will not be unto you, reading the first negative, doing double duty with the second one. So here is a reunion, which is not quite a reunion. Right? And the explanation of what this is, it becomes clear in verse 4, that it is a reunion which describes the exile, is clear in verse 4, because verse 4 picks up the key expressions from verse 3, where he said, many days you are going to continue as mine. And verse 4 says, you're going to do this because for many days Israel, Yamim Rabim Yeshivu, the same expression for many days and the same verb used in verse 3 are repeated in verse 4. So there's no doubt about it. Verse 4 is giving an explanation of the meaning of the symbolism of the marriage in verse 3. And verse 4 then describes Israel's exile, because it says, because for many days Israel is going to continue without king, without prince, without sacrifice, without matzeba puller, without ephod, without teraphim. All of the outward trappings of Israel's life, whether cultic or cultural, genuine or false, their everything that constituted their life in Canaan, their leadership of all kinds, royal and priestly and all of the cultic functions and trappings, everything that constituted life in the land of Canaan is going to be stripped from them, because for many days they're going to be out of the land, huh? Separated from the whole thing, off in exile. Verse 4, there's just no two ways about it. There's a picture of Israel in exile. And Gomer, you are going to continue with me in this marriage situation, which is basically still one, nevertheless, of separation from the marriage bed, because our relationship has to depict the exile of Israel. And so I submit to you then that that's the strange thing, that Israel's exile, or this marriage reunion, is a picture of exile. Now, how can this be? This can be because our analysis of the Old Covenant, which was one that had two levels. You have that typological level up there, where you have the principle of works. And you have, meanwhile, however, the Abrahamic Covenant. So all of this business that we keep dealing with of the structure of covenant theology is really necessary to even to make sense of this symbolism. There's this underlying Abrahamic covenant which is still intact. And even then, when Israel goes into exile, in terms of the Mosaic covenant of judgment, God has not forgotten the Abrahamic covenant. It's a sort of a mixed situation there in exile. In terms of the upper level typological kingdom, they are not my people. They are lo ami, and yet there's the remnant according to the election of grace, and God hasn't forgotten it. Daniel, Ezekiel, the saints, they all go into exile, all right, but they are still God's elect in Jesus Christ, huh? And now, how are you going to depict that? How are you going to pick that double reality that, in one sense, they are cut off from the covenant completely, and yet in this basic sense, in Christ, God hasn't forgotten it, and Christ is going to come and be their Savior. You get that by this sort of strange symbolism of a reunion, which isn't a total reunion. And it's sort of like, you know, the exile was like the years of wandering in the wilderness, the 70 years of exile, the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. Now, the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness was a virtual exile from the land in which they were not God's covenant people anymore. And you remember our discussion that during that time, how did God convey to them the idea that yeah, that they were sort of, the kingdom was in abeyance. They weren't God's people during this time of the wandering, and yet they were still God's people, and he remembered the Abrahamic covenant, and he was going to fulfill it, and they ultimately would get. How did he convey that? Remember our discussion of Exodus 32 and 33, where the problem was, will God's presence be with us? Here's this marriage, huh? Will the husband dwell in his glory? Will he send his spirit? Or will he only send the angel, as he threatened? I'll only send the angel ahead of you, but I won't be there in your presence. And Moses pleads with him, and no, you must be with us. You must remember the Abrahamic covenant. And so God consents, but with a difference. So he does grant the point that he will be there. There is a reunion. God's glory then does come down and dwell in the midst of Israel, that there is the marriage, there is the reunion, but he parks outside the camp. The marriage isn't consummated, as it were. And so in both of these situations, in the exile and in the wandering in the wilderness, you have the same sort of double reality, that in one sense, the typological kingdom, the works arrangement, it's kaput. But in the sense of the Abrahamic promises, it's still valid. How to convey that symbolically? Well, you convey it by sort of a mixed metaphor, a reunion, which isn't a reunion. God's dwelling among them, but outside the camp. Hosea's dwelling with his wife, but not in the marriage bed. And so here is a reunion then, of sorts, which symbolizes the exile judgment. That, however, isn't the last stage in the message. It points to the last stage, however, the very fact then that there is a reunion of some sort does at least indicate that the Abrahamic promises are on their way to fulfillment, and the fifth verse then describes that afterwards. Huh? This situation, described as many days, isn't the end of the story of the covenant. For many days, this judgment will take place. There will be the fall of Israel. But meanwhile, the promised fullness will take place. And afterwards, it will happen. And so when we look at verse 5, then we come to the end of it. It begins with afterwards, acher, and it ends with ba'acharit hayamim. There's our eschatological messianic formula again. So we know now that verse 5 is talking about the messianic age. Beyond the whole old covenant stage of things, there is the new covenant stage, the messianic eschatological end. And what's going to happen within that afterwards time? Well, here again, as in these other C sections, it says afterwards, the children of Israel will return. So the idea, of course, of spiritual returning. They will return, and they will seek unto the Lord their God. They won't be seeking unto Baal anymore. They'll be seeking with all their hearts unto the Lord their God and Jesus Christ, and unto David their king. David their king, prophetic idiom, Old Testament realities being used for the New Testament. Unto the New Testament, we are not looking for that guy David who died and was buried and his grave is still with us. No, we're looking for the greater David who died and was buried and he has risen from the dead, and we are seeking unto him. And so that's the picture. And unto David their king, a little earlier it said they will make for themselves one head, Israel and Judah, all united, no longer divided. Everything that was ideal under the old covenant is being used to describe the new covenant. And David their king, of course, points to the messianic son. And unto David their king, yes, they will fear unto the Lord. It's that godly covenantal fear. They will fear unto the Lord and unto his goodness. And that term for goodness has covenantal overtones. It's the blessing of the covenant. And all of this will take place ba'acharit hayamin, at the end of the days. This will be the final outcome of it, when there will be a marriage that won't be just a reunion in part, but it will be a fully consummated marriage of the bride and the lamb, which is celebrated with much rejoicing. So as you look then at Hosea and these three chapters, as I say, it really does sum up so much of what we've been trying to say, their role as conducting the lawsuit, huh? As pointing to the fulfillment of the Abrahamic promises and the kingdom of Christ. Whole business of prophetic idiom. Any questions, discussion? Two or three?
Yeah.
Chapter five, three? Are we referring to the three sections of the each cycle, or just tell us what you're referring? Yeah.
One and three are literal. It's symbolic of what's happening with Israel.
One and three. Are we talking about verses in chapter three?
Chapter one. All of chapter one together is a whole chapter.
I'm having trouble catching just what your point is. Anyone that can help us here?
This is a nice quote. Chapter 1.
Here's chapter 1, the first cycle.
Right.
Okay, with Hosea's marriage experience, which is a sort of a parable of God's relationship to Israel, okay?
Right.
All right. That's okay. The same thing is true in chapter 2 and chapter 3. They're all the same.
Right. But it's clear in chapter 1.
Yeah. Yeah.
Going on.
Yeah.
It's historical. And three is historical. To get to chapter two, it's more like a story, the story of Israel, instead of being symbolic in the way that chapters one and two. And what are we to assume about what happens to Hosea's life? Are we supposed to assume that this is?
Well, in chapter 2, there isn't, I think I see what you're talking about. In chapter 2, there isn't the explicit reference to Hosea and Gomer. It's playing no more with the names of their children. So the connections are obviously there. You have those three names of Jezreel, Lo Ruhamah, and Lo Ami, which are being dealt with in chapter 2, which is just a development of chapter 1. You can't separate them. And so it's just that in chapter 2, it's an expanded account of this symbolic meaning, which was already suggested in chapter 1 and is suggested again in chapter 3. But it's just a development of the meaning of the symbolism.
It does seem to be sort of a sine wave, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. I have the same feeling.
That I don't have no idea.
A sine wave where you take the marriage and then Israel and then the marriage again, each one reflecting the other?
I don't know if it's later. I'm not getting the point of it. Yeah.
I was going to say, what you're saying is because the emphasis is very clearly in the first one, at face value, the primary thing that strikes you is the literal Hosea's relationship.
Type of Israel, then it shifts to Israel type of the marriage, then back to marriage type of Israel.
Yeah. It isn't so much that Israel is a type of Hosea's marriage at any point along the line. I mean, Hosea's marriage is the thing that is used as an interpretive symbol of Israel, and that's still in case in chapter 2. And I'm sorry, I'm just having trouble getting to what the problem is. Yeah.
The problem is that we want to read chapter 1 and 3 like history.
Oh. We want to read chapters 1 and 3, the marriage relationship, as real history. But it's a history that is so structured by the Lord as to convey. The children are part of the marriage, right?
Yeah, but I'm just saying.
And the children are dealt with in chapter 2, and they're the ones that are striving with the mother, and so the mother's still there in chapter 2. That's Gomer, you know. The children and Gomer are still there in chapter 2, and this is a message that's being delivered to her, and I just don't see any difference.
You still have the marriage in chapter 2, then?
Yeah, well, of course. Yeah, absolutely, sure. It's a marriage relationship of sorts. You will not commit prostitution anymore the way you did before. Moreover, the way I would read the next verse, where it simply says, "Velo tehi le'ish," it's another example of that word ish I've been trying to underscore as we've worked along, where ish means husband. And you will not be to your husband. So there's going to be a marriage, a reunion, but you will not be to your husband. And then it concludes with the phrase, "and also I to you." The Hebrew words are all little words, easily to translate in themselves, but what the sense of them is really puzzling. There's so many possibilities. And let me suggest to you where I end up with this. "I said unto her, for many days now, you're going to continue then with me. There's going to be this official marriage, and within which you won't be unfaithful. You won't have the opportunity to do that. But on the other hand, this marriage will not be consummated. It won't be normal marriage in that sense, because you will not be to your husband. And then as for me, I will not be unto you," reading the first negative, to doing double duty with the second one. So here is a reunion, which is not quite a reunion, all right? And the explanation of what this is becomes clear in verse 4, that it is a reunion which describes the exile, is clear in verse 4, because verse 4 picks up the key expressions from verse 3, where he said, "Many days you are going to continue as mine." And verse 4 says, "You're going to do this because for many days Israel, Yamim Rabim Yeshivu," the same expression for many days and the same verb used in verse 3 are repeated in verse 4. So there's no doubt about it. Verse 4 is giving an explanation of the meaning of the symbolism of the marriage in verse 3. And verse 4 then describes Israel's exile, because it says, "Because for many days Israel is going to continue without king, without prince, without sacrifice, without matseba puller, without ephod, without teraphim." All of the outward trappings of Israel's life, whether cultic or cultural, genuine or false, their everything that constituted their life in Canaan, their leadership of all kinds, royal and priestly and all of the cultic functions and trappings, everything that constituted life in the land of Canaan is going to be stripped from them, because for many days they're going to be out of the land, separated from the whole thing, off in exile. Verse 4, there's just no two ways about it. There's a picture of Israel in exile. And Gomer, you are going to continue with me in this marriage situation, which is basically still one, nevertheless, of separation from the marriage bed, because our relationship has to depict the exile of Israel. And so I submit to you then that that's the strange thing, that Israel's exile, or this marriage reunion, is a picture of exile. Now, how can this be? This can be because our analysis of the Old Covenant, which was one that had two levels. You have that typological level up there, where you have the principle of works. And you have, meanwhile, however, the Abrahamic covenant. So all of this business that we keep dealing with of the structure of covenant theology is really necessary to even to make sense of this symbolism. There's this underlying Abrahamic covenant, which is still intact. And even then, when Israel goes into exile, in terms of the Mosaic covenant of judgment, God has not forgotten the Abrahamic covenant. It's a sort of a mixed situation there in exile. In terms of the upper level typological kingdom, they are not my people. They are lo ami, and yet there's the remnant according to the election of grace, and God hasn't forgotten it. Daniel, Ezekiel, the saints, they all go into exile, all right, but they are still God's elect in Jesus Christ, huh? And now, how are you going to depict that? How are you going to pick that double reality that, in one sense, they are cut off from the covenant completely, and yet in this basic sense, in Christ, God hasn't forgotten it, and Christ is going to come and be their Savior? You get that by this sort of strange symbolism of a reunion which is in a total reunion. And it's sort of like, you know, the exile was like the years of wandering in the wilderness, the 70 years of exile, the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. Now, the 40 years of wandering in the wilderness was a virtual exile from the land in which they were not God's covenant people anymore. And you remember our discussion that during that time, how did God convey to them the idea that, yeah, that they were sort of, the kingdom was in abeyance, they weren't God's people during this time of the wandering, and yet they were still God's people, and he remembered the Abrahamic covenant, and he was going to fulfill it, and they ultimately would get, how did he convey that? Remember our discussion of Exodus 32 and 33, where the problem was, will God's presence be with us? Here's this marriage, huh? Will the husband dwell in his glory? Will he send his spirit? Or will he only send the angel, as he threatened? I'll only send the angel ahead of you, but I won't be there in your presence. And Moses pleads with him, and no, you must be with us. You must remember the Abrahamic covenant. And so God consents, but with a difference. So he does grant the point that he will be there. There is a reunion. God's glory then does come down and dwell in the midst of Israel, that there is the marriage, there is the reunion, but he parks outside the camp. The marriage isn't consummated, as it were. And so in both of these situations, in the exile and in the wandering in the wilderness, you have the same sort of double reality, that in one sense, the typological kingdom, the works arrangement, it's kaput. But in the sense of the Abrahamic promises, it's still valid. How to convey that symbolically? Well, you convey it by sort of a mixed metaphor, a reunion, which isn't a reunion. God's dwelling among them, but outside the camp. Hosea's dwelling with his wife, but not in the marriage bed. And so here is a reunion then, of sorts, which symbolizes the exile judgment. That, however, isn't the last stage in the message. It points to the last stage, however, the very fact then that there is a reunion of some sort does at least indicate that the Abrahamic promises are on their way to fulfillment, and the fifth verse then describes that afterwards. Huh? This situation, described as many days, isn't the end of the story of the covenant. For many days, this judgment will take place. There will be the fall of Israel. But meanwhile, the promised fullness will take place. And afterwards, huh? It will happen. And so when we look at verse 5, then we come to the end of it. It begins with afterwards, acher, and it ends with ba'acharit hayamim. There's our eschatological messianic formula again. So we know now that verse 5 is talking about the messianic age. Beyond the whole old covenant stage of things, there is the new covenant stage, the messianic eschatological end. And what's going to happen within that afterwards time? Well, here again, as in these other C sections, it says afterwards, the children of Israel will return. So the idea, of course, of spiritual returning. They will return, and they will seek unto the Lord their God. They won't be seeking unto Baal anymore. They'll be seeking with all their hearts unto the Lord their God in Jesus Christ, and unto David their king. David their king, prophetic idiom, Old Testament realities being used for the New Testament. Unto the New Testament, we are not looking for that guy David who died and was buried and his grave is still with us. No, we're looking for the greater David who died and was buried and he has risen from the dead, and we are seeking unto him. And so that's the picture. And unto David their king, a little earlier it said they will make for themselves one head, Israel and Judah, all united, no longer divided. Everything that was ideal under the old covenant is being used to describe the new covenant. And David their king, of course, points to the messianic son. And unto David their king, yes, they will fear unto the Lord. It's that godly covenantal fear. They will fear unto the Lord and unto his goodness. And that term for goodness has covenantal overtones. It's the blessing of the covenant. And all of this will take place Ba'acharit HaYamin, at the end of the days, this will be the final outcome of it, when there will be a marriage that won't be just a reunion in part, but it will be a fully consummated marriage of the bride and the lamb, which is celebrated with much rejoicing. So as you look then at Hosea and these three chapters, as I say, it really does sum up so much of what we've been trying to say, their role as conducting the lawsuit, huh? As pointing to the fulfillment of the Abrahamic promises and the kingdom of Christ, the whole business of prophetic idiom. Any questions, discussion? Two or three?
Yeah.
Chapter five, three?
One, two, and three. Because one and three.
Yeah, are we referring to the three sections of the each cycle? Or just tell us what you're referring. Yeah.
One and three are literal. It's symbolic of what's happening with Israel.
What, one and three? Are we talking about verses in chapter three? I'm having trouble catching just what your point is. Anyone that can help us here?
Okay, there's a nice quote, chapter one.
Here's chapter one, the first cycle. Okay, with Hosea's marriage experience, which is a sort of a parable of God's relationship to Israel, okay? All right. That's the same thing is true in chapter two and chapter three. They're all the same. Yeah.
That it reads as this is how he's handled his relationship with his wife.
Yeah.
Going on.
Yeah.
It's historical. And three is historical. But yet, chapter two references is more like a story, the story of Israel, instead of being symbolic in the way that chapters one and two. And what are we to assume about what happens to Hosea's wife?
In chapter two, there isn't. I think I see what you're talking about. In chapter two, there isn't the explicit reference to Hosea and Gomer. It's playing no more with the names of their children. So the connections are obviously there. You have those three names of Jezreel, Lo Ruhama, and Lo Ami, which are being dealt with in chapter two, which is just a development of chapter one. You can't separate them. And so it's just that in chapter two, it's an expanded account of this symbolic meaning, which was already suggested in chapter one and is suggested again in chapter three. But it's just a development of the meaning of the symbolism.
It does seem to be sort of a sine wave, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. I have the same feeling.
That I don't have no is it?
A sine wave where you take the marriage and then Israel and then the marriage again, each one reflecting the other?
I don't know if it's later. I'm not getting the point of it. Yeah.
I was going to say, what you're saying is because the emphasis is clearly in the first one, at face value, the primary thing that strikes you is the literal
marriage.
Hosea's relationship.
Type of Israel, then it shifts to Israel type of the marriage, then back to the marriage type of Israel.
Yeah. It isn't so much that Israel is a type of Hosea's marriage at any point along the line. I mean, Hosea's marriage. Working just with the names of the children rather than working off of the marriage per se. But it's the same historical aspect of it is there, the marriage itself, and all the way through. And all the way through, that historical marriage is used as a symbol of the religious covenantal relation. The children are part of the marriage, right?
Yeah, but I'm just saying.
And the children are dealt with in chapter two, where they're the ones that are striving with the mother, and so the mother's still there in chapter two. That's Gomer, you know. the children in Gomer are still there in chapter 2, and this is a message that's being delivered to her, and I just don't see any difference.
You still have the marriage in chapter 2 then?
Yeah, well, of course. Yeah, absolutely, sure. It's